This is Circulating Ideas. I'm Steve Thomas. My guest today is Jamie LaRue. He's the new director of the Office of Intellectual Freedom at the American Library Association. You can also read his blog at jlarue.com. Jamie, welcome back to the show.
Steve, it's a pleasure to be back.
When you were first on the show, you had just recently left your job at Douglas County and was consulting, and you have now taken on a new position. But I had a question first of, with your new position, do you still do consulting, or is that something you put aside now with your new position?
You know, mostly I'm wrapping up about 5 engagements that I had that I made before I started at ALA. But, you know, occasionally I do still some executive coaching, and I've done a little bit of facilitation.
Okay. So tell listeners about what your new job is at the Office of Intellectual Freedom.
Okay. Well, actually, I'm the director. I'm only the third director. Judy Krug was the first. Barbara Jones was the second. Judy was here for something like 40, 45 years. Mm-hmm. Barbara was kind of an interim director that stretched into about 5, 6 years. So I'm only the third. So the director of the Office for Intellectual Freedom and the executive director and secretary of the Freedom to Read Foundation.
And what is the mission of the office?
You know, in essence, it's to be an advocate for free speech. And I think that falls into 2 pieces. One of them is there's kind of the fighting against censorship. And so a big piece I've learned of this job is support. There are a lot of librarians out there that find themselves under attack. I would say that mostly it's concentrated these days in school libraries, but someone comes in and there's a formal challenge and sometimes a lot of pressure is being placed on the librarian. They holler for help and we try to support them. So that's the first piece, is like fighting censorship. Mm-hmm. The second one, I think, is a more positive spin, and that's an advocate for free speech. So this is the piece that kind of appealed to me after being in Douglas County for 24 years and being in consulting for 2 years. I got really fascinated in this idea about what are the big ideas of librarianship and how do we start communicating them not just to each other but out to that larger world. And I think right now, free speech is under attack in a lot of ways, and it's good to be in a spot where we can try to change the culture in a way that makes it more open to, more responsive to, more willing to talk about things that that we need to talk about.
Yeah, and I think it's important to have this kind of office because of when things come up in the wider culture, like with privacy now is kind of becoming a big thing with the encryption fight and with Apple's fight with the FBI, the Panama Papers, all this kind of stuff coming out now. And it's important that librarians understand our role in all that, too, I think.
Well, that's right. You know, I was talking to Lee Rainey from Pew, and he was talking about this report. And he says, you know, there are really only 3 people that we still trust in America. And the first one is firefighters. The second is nurses. And the third is librarians. And I think it's because, you know, we're not seen as having an agenda. You know, if your house is on fire, the firefighter doesn't say, okay, are you a Democrat or Republican, right? They just put out the fire.
Right.
If you're a nurse, when you come in, you say, well, that was a poor life choice. No, they help fix you. And if you're a librarian, it's like if you come in seeking knowledge, we help you seek knowledge and we help you keep it private, keep it confidential to the best of our ability in this very complex world.
And coming up pretty soon is Choose Privacy Week.
Yeah.
Do you have a specific focus for that this year, or is it kind of just a overall just talking about privacy?
Yeah, there is a specific focus, and that's really the rights of minors. And one of the things that we've done, minors, M-I-N-O-R-S, not minors.
Coal miners.
Right. What we've observed here lately is that, you know, so you take something that starts out being like, it sounds like a good idea. So this would be the notion of anti-bullying and no hate speech in schools. And so then some teenager says something that may not be well considered, might be a little on the bigoted side, but suddenly they're kicked out of school. Or they post something on their Facebook page at home about something that's not particularly school related, and they wind up being kicked out of school. You know, so what we have now is kind of an encroachment into the private life of teens and their own private expression, and it's being turned around to punish them. And so we think that let's stop and think about minors' rights and about which educational records get shared with whom. And when a library passes on some records to a third party, what rights do the minors still have once that record gets traded around among these various corporate partners?
Yeah, and like you said, schools are kind of getting hit by this, the most school librarians and students like that, of having their privacy, I guess, violated is might be a good word for it.
I think that's exactly the word for it.
Yes. Does the OIF have specific tools that they can provide to help out school librarians and other librarians to help spread the word about this kind of thing and to fight back?
Yeah, we sure do. If you do search for Choose Privacy Week, we've put up all kinds of toolkits here that help people. And I would say that I'll start with the one that people often forget, is just to be thoughtful about the records that you collect. Because what we've learned is that educational records are very discoverable. And so if you're a school librarian, think about the record that you're maintaining to decide whether or not you should be maintaining it. You know, sometimes the best way to protect the privacy of a patron is someone comes in and asks you a question, you have a record of the conversation, then you throw it away. Because people... But first of all, minors are people too, and they investigate things that sometimes are difficult. And it doesn't mean that they're engaging in terrible behavior. It means maybe a friend is, and they're trying to read about it and think about it. So we need to protect that confidentiality of our young folks.
Yeah, and I think that's important, because I think a lot of times minors are discarded in those kind of conversations, where you just kind of push them off to the side. So I like that the focus is on that this year.
Good.
With privacy and things like that, we've got other groups like Allison Macrina's Library Freedom Project trying to work on also getting the word out about that kind of thing. Are there other ways that the OIF is trying to get the word out about privacy and intellectual freedom?
Back to the privacy notion is that we've teamed up with the EFF, Electronic Freedom Foundation, to push this Let's Encrypt project. And the idea here is that when you do banking, you see that you've gone from HTTP to HTTPS. So it's an encrypted protocol, a tunnel through the internet where people can't listen in on you. Well, we do a lot of fairly confidential exchanges across library websites. So you're putting in your PIN number, you're putting in your library card number. That might give someone access to your entire patron record and your reading history. And so we think it's about time that we step up our game and adopt the HTTPS protocol. So the way you do that is you have to kind of buy a certificate, or you did have to buy it. Now you can get that for free. As Michael Robinson, who's the chair of our Intellectual Freedom Committee's Privacy Subcommittee, he says it's free as in kittens, you know, meaning that it doesn't cost anything to get it, but then you have to take care of it. And so the installation of that protocol can be a little tricky. But do a search on that Let's Encrypt, and talk to your IT department. And we're really hoping that we can make a splash with this and get, you know, as many as 5 to 10% of libraries would be good to adopt this protocol on their website.
And I noticed the last time that I checked, I think hopefully the ALA itself will start encrypting their website, because I don't believe they're HTTPS yet.
Yeah, we've got everything that has to do with money, everything that has to do with private logins is pretty encrypted, but there's still a lot of stuff to be done. So, yeah, this is one of those time to practice what we preach.
Well, and it's nice now that all these tools are coming out that make it free and low cost, because that's part of the reason I think libraries maybe didn't jump on it before, because it's like we already have constrained budgets that it's hard to prioritize sometimes.
Well, and here we are coming out of the recession, and I think everybody feels like, okay, let's take a breath and start figuring out which IT projects make sense. And I would strongly urge your listeners to put this one pretty close to the top of the list.
And do you know the story back? I know Judith Krug had created it way back 50 years ago or so now. What the story was behind why ALA wanted to create the office in the first place?
You know, that's a really good question. No, I haven't had a chance to dig back to that. I think that what was happening, so this would put it back in the 60s, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think that the big struggle of the day probably came around this notion of in loco parentis. So if your child goes off to a public library, do you have the same obligations that they do in a school where they're kind of acting on behalf of the parent?
Right.
And it became clear, and I think as a result of court cases and a lot of public advocacy, that no, in the public library, it's not in loco parentis. And so I think that's this goes all the way back to my early childhood. I can remember when I first got my library card, I was in a bookmobile, and there was a blue line that was painted along the top of the third shelf. And I thought, oh, how cool. So all the kids' books are under here because we're shorter. That made sense. And then one day I tried to check out something that was above the blue line, and my librarian wouldn't let me have it. And I was like, well, what's this about? How come? And I said, well, you're not old enough. And so I remember I've talked to a lot of people of my age who remember that, and that's not true anymore. Now kids are encouraged to read anything that they can understand. And I think that's good. That's the beginning of a recognition that minors have minds too.
Yeah, no, definitely. One of the other big projects that OIF does is the, I'm blanking on the name of it now, the challenge reporting.
the database, yeah.
Yeah, so OIF does challenge reporting, and you have the database, and just recently put out the book of the list of the top 10 most challenged books.
Yeah, 215's top 10 challenge books. And I should back up and say that this database, we call it a database, but it is not a comprehensive scientific study.
Right.
What it is a combination of two things. First, it's a support database. So I mentioned that if a librarian gets into trouble and gives us a call, we gather as much information as they're willing to share, and often they are saying it's confidential. Mm. They don't want to lose their jobs. So that customer support, member support is a big part of the reporting. And then the other thing that we do is we have all sorts of Google alerts, and we troll through the news trying to find anything that looks related to book banning or challenges to books. So it winds up being a snapshot of what's going on in America. Not comprehensive, but I think illustrative.
And what kind of books showed up on this year's lists?
As we take a look at it, we said we think that 9 of the top 10 had diverse content. So we had books like I Am Jazz, Beyond Magenta. There's another one that escapes me right now. Oh, Two Boys Kissing, that were either LGBT or trans, so that's kind of a longstanding trend. And then we had a couple of books, one was Habibi, the other one was Nazarene's Secret School, that featured Islamic characters, Muslim characters. And so there was clearly some discomfort with anything in our libraries about the Islamic culture. And then we had a couple of books that were also featuring what we think of as disabilities. So a really interesting book, I just finished reading it, was The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime by Mark Haddon. And this one where the main character is autistic. And a really interesting kind of a book about that. And then the number one book was Looking for Alaska, that although the challenge was more that it was sexually explicit, offensive language, drug use, alcohol, one of the main characters there, or a secondary character, has severe depression. So again, kind of falling into the disability. The one that the book that seems to have gotten the greatest attention is the fact that the Bible was on the list this year. And I find that fascinating. In my mind, not at all surprising that it's there. The Bible has been on and off the list of the books that we keep track of, meaning that it's challenged around the country. Then it disappeared for 7 years. Nobody was reporting a challenge to it. And last year it showed up in the top 10.
So can you talk about what the reasons that people were challenging the Bible? What were the reasons people were challenging that? Because we kind of hear in the press, we hear a lot of times about people challenging Korans or things like that, but we don't hear a lot about the...
Yeah, I was surprised that we didn't have as many challenges to the Quran as we had to the Bible. And I think that really it comes down to three things. The first one is there's the mistaken belief that just owning the Bible in a school library or a public library somehow violates the separation of church and state. And that is mistaken. It's been clearly determined that if I have a religious scripture in the library there for private study, alongside the Bhagavad Gita, the Book of Mormon, the sutras of Buddha, all those things are perfectly okay because we're not establishing a state religion in that process.
Right.
The second thing is, I think we saw a spate of what looked to me like almost retaliation challenges. So this past year, we saw the resurgence of this religious liberty kind of bill. Indianapolis or Indiana, Georgia, Mississippi, where they adopt laws that seem to overturn the protections for gay and lesbian and trans. And so someone gets angry about that and they come in and they say, well, if you're going to deny me a house or deny me a birthday cake or whatever, then I'm going to try to ban the Bible. So kind of challenges on that level.
Challenging the challenges.
Yeah. And then I think that the third one is kind of interesting too, and I find this one almost ironic. For instance, recently in Virginia, there was an attempt to pass a law that would have required parental notification of any book in an English class for like AP English in high school. They would have to say whether or not there was any explicit sex in it. And the strategy around that is people would stand up and say, well, I'm going to read you this outrageous passage from Beloved by Toni Morrison. And the problem, of course, is that if you just pull excerpts from a classic book, and I would argue that Beloved is a classic, you lose the larger picture, right? Nobody read the whole book. Well, that kind of same thing happens with the Bible, where somebody comes in and says, you know, the Bible's not appropriate for young people. And you'd say, excuse me, why is that? And they'd say, well, and they would point to Lot's daughters, where Lot offers them up to a gang coming in, they're virgins, and he offers them up for gang rape. And later on, the daughters try to get Lot drunk and have sex with him so they can have kids. And we have people say, well, that's not appropriate for young people. So again, it's taking things out of context. It's saying, well, yeah, it's the Bible too is a classic and has the ability to challenge us and to inspire us. And like any book that tackles big themes, sometimes the themes aren't pretty.
And one of the things that I liked from the first time we talked is that you had talked about where you had talked to some, when you were at Douglas County, you had had some interactions with some of your patrons about things that they wanted to take out of the library. But you talked about that it's really important to be respectful to the people that you're challenging with. You're not just, no, you're wrong and we're right. And it's creating a respectful dialogue with people to find out why they're wanting to challenge these things and try to work with them and make them understand our values, not just like say it from above.
Well, that's exactly right. You know, because it's so easy for people to get arrogant on either side of a debate. And I think that in my mind, free speech means this fundamental respect for the dignity of inquiry. And I think that, I had someone talk about this the other day, and they said, you know, how is it that, you know, doesn't it just make you angry when a religious conservative comes in and wants to challenge a book? And I said, you know, I think that there is one area where both librarians and, you know, very religious conservative Christians agree, and that's that books are important, that the word is important, that we have kind of a shared reverence for the written word. And I really believe that that's true. So what that means is you don't know what you're going to be thinking or believing next year. It behooves us all to be kind and to listen to each other.
That's great. Yeah, because, yeah, I mean, that's a great observation because, yeah, the reason that they want these things removed is because they feel the power of that is going to compel somebody to do something bad. Whereas, I mean, we have a different view of that, but they really do see the power of that. So.
Well, that's right. You know, and when you get raised to say that the book is, you know, the Bible is holy and it tells you things and you have to do them, that's great. So you have this kind of reverence. But we know as librarians that just because you come in and read mysteries doesn't make you a murderer. Right. You know, and it's very seldom that somebody comes in and says, I am a strong advocate for A and I want to read everything opposite to A. They look for things that confirm their beliefs. So if you just read something that disagrees with your long-standing belief system, it doesn't overturn it overnight.
Well, and that's one of the things I think that's important about keeping that freedom to have all those different points of view on the shelf so that as people maybe do start to, especially when they're younger, people tend to do that more of trying to expand their thoughts and get into new ways of thinking about things. And so having those on the shelf already and not, as we talked about earlier, not restricting minors from being able to look at those things, that it helps open their minds when they're young. Because yeah, once you get older, yeah, you kind of get entrenched in your beliefs, and you just want to confirm that confirmation bias kind of stuff.
So. Yeah, well, that's exactly right. You know, and then the other thing to go back to the idea about minors. Often someone will say, you know, when they're saying we need parental notification, we have to protect our children, you know, from exposure to explicit sex. Well, you've got kids, and you know that there are differences in age. Children can be anything from 4 years old to 17 years old.
Right.
You know, and when you're 16 and 17 and you're in high school and you're reading advanced placement books, you'll be old enough to get married and to vote and to go to war the next year. And so surely the rights of a mature minor to investigate the world and say, you know, they're curious about it because they're right on the threshold of it. And my belief is that reading is one of the safest ways to begin to explore the world and to understand what you might be getting into. What could be safer than a classroom? And as I always say, the safest sex is just reading about it.
Well, and we always tell people at my library that when they ask about whether they can restrict what their kids can check out and things like that, it's like, well, that's your responsibility as the parent to decide what is best for your child. You know, that's not, we don't want to restrict that just whole cloth over the entire community. It's, if you want to restrict what your child can check out, then be with your child when they're checking out and don't let them check it out.
That's right. And, you know, and only your child, you know, not every other child.
Right, right.
And the other part that I find, you know, fascinating and sad. So somebody says, okay, we need to pass a law that the government will describe whether or not there's explicit sex, government in the form of school librarians or English teachers, that you will give us a warning about any of these things. And I always say, well, wouldn't it just be easier to say, hey, son, what are you reading?
Mm-hmm.
You know, can we talk about that? And I know that if you can establish this kind of dialogue with your children, and I worked very hard to do that with my own kids, that meant that if they read something that did disturb them, they could come and talk to you about it.
Right, you keep that dialogue open so that they know that they can talk to you.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, because that's when I was growing up, my wife as well, it worked well because we can do that with our children now too, is when we were growing up, we were allowed to read whatever we wanted. I mean, there was maybe some TV that they would, or movies that they would, because the visual image is a little harder to deal with, but book-wise, we could read whatever we wanted, and then, yeah, you just ask if you have questions. So.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, I think that running... It's true in our culture, we have the sense that if you read something, it goes through a linguistic filter, right? And so it's the pictures in your own head, as opposed to if you look at a movie, there's some kind of more visceral image that's communicated that kind of bypasses that linguistic filter. But my take on this one, and it's funny, is I've been talking to people who've been pushing back about this, you know, parental notification. You know, I'm a big believer that librarians encourage you to read more. You know, we don't think reading is dangerous. We think reading is good.
Right. I also wanted to talk to you about the, there's a Judy Krug Memorial Fund that gives out grants.
Yeah.
And that application is coming up, so I wanted to bring that to you, bring that up with you. And it's so people can do events during banned books weeks. Can you talk about that?
Grants? This is, you know, I've been in my job now for 90 days, so pardon the lack of depth of some of these responses. But yes, this was a fund that was established to encourage, you know, greater visibility around Banned Books Week. This is to kind of honor Judy's memory and her long work in this field. But all that I can tell you, I think, is I've seen that the description for what the grant applications, I think, are on the OIF landing page. So just do OIF ALA and Google that up and it'll come up and find the instructions there to turn in the applications. We've gotten a few of them and they're all very, very clever, very good. I know in the past we've had things like trading cards of banned books and it's just a wonderful opportunity to begin this dialogue with your community.
Right, because Banned Book Weeks isn't until the fall, but I was looking at the site, and the grant application is May 15th, 2016. So.
Okay, well, thank you, Steve. I appreciate that commercial. But we have money to give away, so do sign up.
Yeah, so go to oif.ala.org to find out more about that.
Thank you.
And the last thing I wanted to ask you about, and this, I'm almost hoping this will be a done deal by the time this episode comes out, but what are your thoughts on Carla Hayden as Librarian of Congress?
I think it's wonderful that we're getting a librarian, and particularly one that has thought a lot about the digital future of the library. Library of Congress is such an important institution, and we need to be looking to them for leadership. Carla, you know, here I am in Chicago. She's kind of a native girl, local girl makes good, you know. And, you know, having that experience with a large system like Chicago Public and then on to Baltimore, I think it'd be wonderful. So I know that her hearings are coming up. I think it's next week, right?
Yeah, it'll actually be last week by the time this comes out. So.
Okay, gotcha. So yeah, so I'll be listening in on that one to see how all that goes.
Yeah, it's nice that they're gonna that they are doing it. You know, they're live streaming it and all this kind of stuff. I don't know if they always live stream hearings and we just don't pay attention usually. This is not about the librarianship, but it's nice that it's being live streamed so you can watch it live and find out. All right. The last question I wanted to ask is, what made you want to take on this job? I mean, what was appealing about it that made you want to take it on?
I think that this is the only job like this in the world. There are many national library associations around the world. There is no other office for intellectual freedom. And I find that as I talk to many librarians, we have such a deep-seated sense that this is our core value. This is the thing we believe. Anybody who comes into the library, whatever they ask, we're going to do our level best to honor that, to help them find things out. And a society that no longer values freedom of inquiry is one that is well on its way to tyranny. So I think that over the past, say, 25, 30 years, America's libraries have done a wonderful job of growing use, of opening up our collections, of growing the number of people that have library cards, increasing library visits, increasing the number of books in the home. All of those things are great. But we have not succeeded in growing support for the library mission. So what I've decided I want to do with this, the last half of my career, or however many years there might be in it, is I want to take that message to the people. I want to remind them that librarianship is a noble profession, and that there is a fundamental dignity to human inquiry, and we need to honor that.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Jamie. And where can people go if they want to contact you to learn more?
I'm at jlarue, J-L-A-R-U-E, at ALA.org.
All right. Thanks a lot, Jamie.
Okay. Thanks, Steve.
Hey, bye. Circulating Ideas is produced by Steve Thomas in the suburbs of Atlanta. Music is by Pamela Klicka. If you'd like to learn more about the show, listen to past episodes, or read transcripts, visit circulatingideas.com. You can follow the show on Twitter at @CircIdeas, like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/circulatingideas, or drop me an email at mail@circulatingideas.com. If you'd like to support the show, visit patreon.com/circideas. And please rate, review, and recommend the show on iTunes, Overcast, Stitcher, or your podcast app of choice to help others find the show. Thank you for listening, and keep circulating the ideas.
Yeah, I remember taking my daughter to all of her soccer lessons, and she would get out in the middle of the field, and she would start writing messages to herself in the sky with her arms, and she'd be all dreamy, and the ball would be flying past her. And
yeah, my son does that where he'll sit down and start pulling grass out of the when he's playing t-ball. He'll sit down and start pulling grass out of the ground.
Yeah, wonderful.
And then the last practice just a couple of days ago, he's changed now too. I guess he's becoming a boy. He points up at the sky and sees airplanes and goes bam 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 bam. I'm like, okay, no.
Okay, that's right. My son, the terrorist. Yeah.